the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. Today is a special fun show. We have a prequel, so to speak. We have Graham Hancock, who is now one of the Netflix superstars with his Apocalypse Now series that are, I think they're in their second season now, and he has gotten lots of controversy. He's all over Joe Rogan and all of that group of podcasters. This is when I interview him when he's still an economist writer for The Economist magazine. So 12 years ago, before a lot of this stuff has happened, before his career has become astronomically huge, we have Graham Hancock. So this will be fun for all of you who know who he is and are interested in this space. He's one of the pyramids is a power plant type guys. Then before that, actually, we have Scott Sturrett with us. He is with an organization called Venture for Canada. It's an amazing entrepreneurial support group with financial aid, classes, networking, all of the pieces that you would expect. Scott built it from scratch, and it is doing tremendously well. And so I'm excited to welcome him. He has a book out as well called The Uncertainty Book. We have an amazing conversation about that, and really excited for you to meet Scott as well. So I'm getting inundated with emails about China and why I say that the government there is about to collapse and that they're in imminent danger. So I want to respond very quickly. First, the real estate sector has collapsed, and you have some of the biggest companies, Evergreen, for example, which is starting to default on loans. And so the entire sector is amazingly overbuilt, perhaps 100 million units more than they need. Yes, 100 million more than they need. But even more striking, there are lots of claims out there. And again, I'm just quoting stuff from YouTube and then running it past the people I know, that the population of China has collapsed several hundred thousand people. It's not over a billion anymore because of cell data and burn rates at crematoriums and things like that. Empty cities where there's just no one there. All government workers, not all, tons of government workers are unpaid and have been unpaid for several months. The natural disasters that are absolutely been the worst ever there are giving the perception to the average person that China is falling apart because cars are just dropping into holes. And all of that, it's the psychological effect. It's just, we're on the cusp, my friends. We're on the cusp. We'll be right back with a great show. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. I'm very excited to introduce my first guest. He is calling in from Canada. Please welcome Scott Sturrett to the show. He has a new book out called The Uncertainty Advantage, Launching Your Career in an Era of Rapid Change. Scott is very active in the Canadian entrepreneurial ecosystem. He has created an organization there that is designed to help us entrepreneurs. It is called Venture for Canada, and it is a nationwide movement that helps equip early stage entrepreneurs with the skills and the network and the mindset and all of that. About 10,000 young people have gone through their system, and they've raised about $80 million in funding. Very impressive. Scott, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thanks so much for having me on. And I am doing great. Looking forward to the conversation.
Likewise. All right. So how did Venture for Canada come to be? How did you get the idea, and what'd you do?
The idea came through my experience living actually in the United States. I am Canadian, but I spent 5 years living in the US. I went to school at Georgetown. And when I was at Georgetown, I'd seen an organization that no longer exists, but was called Venture for America and was founded by Andrew Yang, who ended up becoming more famous later when he ran for president of the United States.
Right.
And I thought it was a great idea. Essentially, Adventure for America recruits, trains, and supports young Americans to go work at startup companies right out of college. And I had some friends who did the program, and I thought, this is an amazing idea. Why don't we do this in Canada? And that was the spark for founding Venture for Canada.
Excellent. I love that. Copy someone else. That's certainly one of our philosophies. So what did you do? How did you go about building it?
The first step was doing initial research and customer validation to get a sense of, do people actually want this in Canada? So connecting with recent grads, connecting with startups, seeing whether there was actual demand for the program. And then I started to recruit people to become advisors. I incorporated the organization. And after that, started to fundraise. And when I first left to Goldman Sachs to go found Venture for Canada, initially, we really had no resources. So it was building it with a very constrained budget and really pitching people on this idea of a program that didn't exist at that time. And gradually over time, we scaled our funding to today. We have close to $15 million annual budget, 30 full-time employees. And step by step, year by year, we grew more and more into a national movement.
Wow, that's amazing. 30 employees and a $50 million, you said, annual budget?
15.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
Thanks.
So when you went and got feedback from people, what did they say? What was the response?
The response was that there was a real gap in Canada for a program like this, and that people would apply to Venture for Canada. And also, when I spoke to other not-for-profits in Canada that worked in the entrepreneurship youth development space, they encouraged me to go create this new organization because they believed that this was a sort of empty space and that there was a need for a new organization working on this. So my customer validation really demonstrated to me why I should leave my job and go launch this full time.
Well, it obviously is working very well. So congratulations. And it's all funded now by rich Canadians, Canadian government. Who's paying every year?
It's a mixture of different funding sources. So there is the Government of Canada as a major donor to Venture for Canada. There's also a lot of the major Canadian banks. So World Bank of Canada, TD Bank, which is also big in the US, Scotiabank, and also a variety of high net worth individuals in Canada, family foundations that support our work. And in some of our activities, we also charge like tuition. So we're funded from a pretty wide range of sources.
Yes, that's amazing. Very well done. When you went to the banks, how did they respond? Were they immediate or did it take a lot of selling?
It took some time. RBC was the first bank to come on board to support Venture for Canada. And it took maybe around a year between the first conversation and then coming on board. And the initial grant was very small. It was like $20,000 Canadian. Today, for context, you know, RBC provides over $200,000 annually in funding. And they're one of Venture for Canada's largest donors. So we've been lucky to have a lot of support from Canadian financial institutions. They've been really steady partners to our work.
Excellent. What about the government? That seems like it would be very difficult to get the government to do anything.
The Government of Canada has been the biggest supporter of Venture for Canada. Our current funding from the government is almost $12 million per year. So it's a very significant amount of funding in terms of the organization. And today we have around five programs. Two of them are wholly funded by the Government of Canada. And through that, we support thousands of young people to get practical work experience each year. And our current government funding started kind of at this level and the current source of government funding began around 7 years ago. So we've been grateful to have the support for almost 7.5 years.
That's very impressive and amazing. You can get the government to do something that quickly and productively. I'm impressed. All right. And you said five programs?
Approximately. It can vary depending on the time, but yeah, that's the typical number.
Excellent. Doing what? What are the different versions or what's the difference?
We have a internship program where we support current post-secondary students, so college students, to do 4-month-long internships at small businesses. We support a entrepreneurship program where we support current post-secondary students to do short-duration projects that are 4 to 6 hours a week over 7 weeks at small businesses across Canada. We have a fellowship program where we support recent graduates to get jobs in high-growth startups and learn AI skills so that they can successfully begin their careers. We have a program called Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition Academy that we help young people learn how to buy businesses. In the US, there's a lot more initiatives like this. We're one of the first initiatives in Canada really focused on how to help people learn the business buying process because it's quite complicated. And then we have a variety of other programs, the ones that have at different times supported international students in Canada, supported people to develop leadership experience across the not-for-profit, for-profit, and public sector. So the fifth is kind of a rotating mixture of things, but that's a high-level overview of Venture for Canada's programs today.
Amazing. Great job. Fantastic. You know, at Georgetown campus, there is the International Studies building, a big brick building, and it's got an amphitheater kind of attached to it.
Of course, yeah. I think you're talking about the ICC, Intercultural Center. It's where like the School of Foreign Service building exactly. is. Yeah,
that's where I got my first kiss.
Oh, did you grow up in? Did you go to Georgetown, or did you grow up in the area?
I did a summer program there, and I got my first kiss in that courtyard or the. Oh,
that's that's always a special that place must bring a special place in your heart.
My kids and I just went to DC for spring break 3 or 4 months ago, and I took them there just to see that spot. So they weren't as impressed as I was.
Well, it is a very unique it's called Red Square, but that square is pretty unique as well, because it's the one place on Georgetown campus where it's like a free speech zone. So Georgetown has also a unique system where free speech like protests are kind of regulated. A lot of universities you can protest anywhere, but that Red Square is like the one place where people can do like kind of protests unencumbered. So it has a unique legal status within Georgetown campus as well, which is a fun fact.
Very interesting. I didn't know that. All right. Congratulations on the book, The Uncertainty Advantage: Launch Your Career in an Era of Rapid Change. Tell us about the book.
The book is a guide for young people, specifically recent graduates of college, to learn how to embrace the uncertainty of our era and turn it into an advantage in their career. And the book goes through 6 pillars of advice, including self-compassion, adaptability, and entrepreneurial mindset. And it provides really practical, tactical advice on how people can learn to develop a better relationship with uncertainty. But more than just like a guide for early career professionals, it also speaks a lot to my own personal experiences in my 20s. I'm 34 now, so my 20s weren't that long ago. But it talks about my experiences at Georgetown navigating uncertainty, going to get a job at Goldman Sachs, leaving Goldman Sachs to go create Venture for Canada, my struggles in COVID, getting diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder and really struggling with uncertainty, and almost dying at Georgetown from a significant health issue related to wisdom teeth removal. And anyway, all of these personal stories, I think I share in the sense the book is not just do all these things, but it is, I use a lot of my personal stories and my own life experiences to speak about why building your uncertainty muscles is so important and how you can do it.
Well, how do you deal with uncertainty? I mean, what are the keys? You said you said 3 things. I was trying to get the 6 self something, and then adaptability, and 3 was mindset. What was self? What?
Self-compassion.
Compassion. Okay. So yeah. How do you navigate the uncertainty and not freak out?
Yeah. I'll say a few kind of key points. One is on the topic of self-compassion, is the importance of speaking to yourself in a kind way, which is particularly important in a world where things can spin out of control really quickly. And you can be adversely impacted by events completely beyond your control. So self-compassion is a really important part of navigating uncertainty. A second key aspect of navigating uncertainty is adaptability. And that means not setting really rigid plans for yourself, but thinking in terms of kind of quarters. So like, what are you doing in the short term? And being ultimately guided by your values and your life mission, and not setting really rigid plans for yourself. And a third piece of navigating uncertainty that I would recommend is the person entrepreneur mindset. And that means always looking and trying to spot opportunities. So that could be talking with a wide range of people. That could be reading a wide range of different news sources. And then as importantly, acting. So running experiments constantly, testing different things out. All of these three pillars, of which, by the way, there's three other pillars, which I didn't mention, which I'm happy to kind of later. But the three pillars I just talked about, those are all things that you can practically implement to develop a better relationship with uncertainty.
Well, you got to give us the other three or my obsessive compulsive order will freak out. So give us 4, 5, and 6.
The other three are the importance of generalist skills like collaboration, working with other people. And in a world where technical skills perhaps are going to become less important because AI will automate that. We're already seeing a lot of the negative impact of AI on software engineering jobs. The generalist skills are going to be really important in order to thrive in an uncertain world. Another core pillar of the uncertainty advantage is the importance of network building. So building a network that works for you and that also helps other people. So that means building a network that's both wide and deep. What I mean by wide is think about ways you can engage a large number of people in a more low touch capacity. That could be creating an email newsletter where you send out personal updates once a month and interesting articles and books that you've read. I do that. And it's been a great way to keep in touch with like 1400 different people who I know more loosely. It's also important to have deep relationships. That means showing up for friends, meaningfully investing in relationships. And both are really important because in a world that's uncertain and can potentially cause a lot of havoc, who you know and that professional network will help you if you lose your job or if you need to launch a new business. And investing in relationships is a really important part of navigating uncertainty. And the final pillar that I'll talk about is anti-fragility, which is essentially thinking about how do you gain from disorder. So resilience is just tolerating disorder. Anti-fragility is becoming better in the face of chaos. And one of the ways you can become more anti-fragile is thinking about building up your risk-taking muscles every day. So that could be taking small risks to gradually push yourself out of your comfort zone. And if every day you take a little bit of a risk, over time, your risk-taking capacity increases significantly, and hence your ability also to cope with uncertainty. So those are the other three.
I love it. So on networking, I used to be a professor at Georgia State University, small p, not capital P. I don't have my PhD, but I was teaching international entrepreneurship, and we did a trip every year. We'd go to India to study entrepreneurs, or we went all over the world. And one of the exercises that we did was each student had to do a deep dive into a person and then a wide dive into a bunch of people. So that we created a survey that they had to get 10 different people to answer. And then we had an assignment where they had to go and spend an entire day with an entrepreneur, and they had to find that person from America before we left. And that was, building your ability to find a person who's going to spend the day with you. And we called it wide and deep. It had to, engage with the international community in two different ways. And so I love that you were using the same terms. And I love your strategy of developing a little bit of risk as you go along. I've always been trying to help people who are introverts become more extroverted. I'm an incredible introvert, but I can't make a living being an introvert. And one of the things is just go sit at the bar at a restaurant, just sit at a bar and try to talk to people. People at a bar are usually very talkative. And so don't wait, or you can just wait for someone to ask you, what you're doing and, you know, learned to become a little more extroverted each time by just sitting at a bar and taking tiny little risks. And so I love your number 5 and 6. I have done both of those myself. And I love the term anti-fragility. That's a really interesting one. So well done with all of that.
Thank you. Yeah, I relate. I'm more introverted as well. And I've been doing as much freaking out full time for 11 and a half years. And because of the nature of my job, I have to interact with a lot of people every day who are strangers to me. And I feel like my own risk-taking muscles and my own ability just to interact with a wide range of people has gradually increased because of that daily practice. And it's like anything, if you keep on practicing it, you keep on getting into your comfort zone, you become more comfortable with it over time.
Yes, very true. Well, congratulations on the book. How did you get it published and how did you actually write it? Did you sit down at the computer and just bang it out? Did you dictate and then edit that? What was your actual writing process? And then how did you get it published? How'd you get your publisher to your publishing deal?
The writing process was quite intense at different points. So I wrote the first draft of the manuscript in 3 months and while doing a full-time job. And that was definitely intense. I don't think I've written 60,000 words in 3 months before. And that was just, you know, kind of being like a steamroller and just every day, you know, writing for hours, writing through weekends and writing in evenings, mornings, and just going completely focused on writing for 3 months. I'm not someone who suffers from writer's block very much at all. So I just kind of cut out a lot of other things from my life and focused on the book. And for me, it wasn't necessarily blocking specific time. It was just saying kind of whenever I have free time, devote to writing for a period of time. And I think for me, I also enjoyed the book writing, so I didn't find it like a chore. So I ended up, that was my kind of routine at a high level. In terms of the book deal, the book's published through Dundurn Press, which is one of Canada's oldest and largest publishers. And it came about through a connection to the former publisher of Dundurn, who I met. And I said, hey, I'm kind of working on this book idea. And then he said, we'd like to buy this book. And then I got a publishing contract. So I had a little bit of a quite unusual path into publishing a book through a traditional publisher. A lot of the times you would write a book proposal and you would go get an agent and you chop it around. So if you're listening and you're interested in getting a traditional book deal, my path is quite unusual. That being said, there's no one path to getting a book deal. It can vary significantly, but I definitely benefited a little bit from good luck in terms of just knowing the former publisher.
No, that's just good networking. And that's a great way for anyone to learn to do it, you know? So, I've had, I don't know, 15 or 20 publishers on this show. And that's a great way to meet people too. Start a podcast and then invite publishers on. So I like your method a lot. I think that's a great way to do it. But you're right, though. Normally there's more shopping around and all of that. And that can be a pain in the butt. So
through podcasts and radio, so shows like this. And I'm doing around 30 this year. So speaking of a wide range of podcasts across Canada and the United States. Two is through email newsletter. So I didn't have any mail newsletter before. Now I have around 1,400 subscribers. And usually there's a kind of open rates of 55 to 60%. Pretty strong click-through rates, usually around like 10 to 12%. So I've built a pretty engaged list of people. I have an advanced reader team of around 80 people, which is a pretty big advanced reader team. So mobilizing them all to promote the book actually next week on social media, because it comes out in Canada on August 19th, September 16th in the US. And doing events across post-secondary institutions, so colleges and universities in different countries. And those are some of the main ways. Also doing a little bit of Amazon advertising. Yeah, for listeners, if you're interested in writing a book, and then, you know, writing is just the end of writing is just the beginning of the journey. The marketing of the book is half the process. And you don't think so?
90%.
90%.
90%.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually love both. I love the writing of the book. I think I maybe enjoy the marketing piece even more because there's a lot of room for creativity.
Scott, no, that you've lost your introversion.
I know. I think, well, that's a point I think too, that, you know, your introversion extroversion scale can, I think, evolve over time. So I think I'm a lot more extroverted today than I was 10 or 15 years ago.
Definitely. You get comfortable, and as it, you know, as time goes on, you just get more and more ease doing it and reaching out and stuff like that. So yeah, definitely you can become less introverted over time, I think.
Totally. And likewise, related to the same topic, is I think someone's comfort with uncertainty can evolve over time. On my website, I have this uncertainty quiz that people can fill out. And I've had 150 people fill it out. And when I do sessions about the book, I get people to fill out this quiz at the beginning. And one of the main takeaways from some of these sessions I've been doing is that people say, well, I think I was a 20 out of 43 when I was 22, but now at 35, I'm like a 35 out of 43. 48 is the highest that you can score in terms of your comfort with uncertainty. And I think sometimes people think that, you know, our identities are static, when a lot of our personality traits can actually ebb and flow based on a variety of factors over the course of our lives.
I think so. Yes. Is there a central philosophy that you have, Scott, or that Venture for Canada has about entrepreneurship? For example, I'm a big believer in bootstrapping. I'm a big believer in copying someone else's idea and just doing it better than they do. I don't really care about passion entrepreneurially. I think that will come over time. And I don't think you should find your passion and necessarily start a business there. That doesn't guarantee success, in my opinion. Do you have a philosophy, or does BFC have a philosophy that you espouse?
I totally agree on the follow your passion. And I critique that concept in my book as well. There's a whole section about why you shouldn't follow your passion or necessarily follow your passion. If I was to say there is a one overarching kind of entrepreneurship philosophy of myself and Venture for Canada, it's that everyone needs to develop entrepreneurial skills, and that entrepreneurial skills does not equal founding something. Entrepreneurial skills are the ability to identify and act upon opportunity to create value for others. At a high level, entrepreneurial skills are kind of meta skill that actually encompasses 15 different sub skills. And we use a framework called EntreComp that stands for the Entrepreneurial Competency Framework. And it was created through the European Commission and an institute they have called the Joint Research Center. And a lot of people think, oh, well, I'm not entrepreneurial because I haven't founded something. But everyone can be entrepreneurial in the context of their lives and careers.
Great advice. Well, Scott, congratulations on the organization and on the book. How do we find out more, get in touch, follow you, get a copy?
The book is coming out on September 16th in the United States. You can buy the book on Amazon.com. You can also buy the book at Barnes & Noble in the United States. And to learn more about my work, you can also check out my website, which is stirt.com, STI2RS2T.com. And those are some of the ways that you can go and check out and buy the book.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Scott. Congratulations, and I hope it sells really well for you.
Thank you. I appreciate it, and it was great speaking with you today.
And we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
And welcome back to School for Startups Radio again. Thank you so much for being with us. I am very excited to introduce you to my next guest. You're going to love or hate this story, but I promise you that it'll be one of the most fascinating things that you ever hear. Graham Hancock was a reporter for The Economist magazine in East Africa in the early 80s, and he ran across a man, a monk, who claimed to be the guard of the Ark of the Covenant. You remember the thing from the Indiana Jones movie, right? And he spent some time studying this, and he published a book in 1992 called The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant, which was an incredibly provocative, best-selling book. And after that, he soon followed up with his most important book called The Fingerprints of the Gods, which has sold, I think, something like 5 to 6 million copies around the world. It has been translated, 7 million copies, and it's been translated into 30 languages. He has spent an entire career now talking about this book, defending it. He has had BBC specials made about him. He has had all sorts of incredible life events because of it. And he has a new book out now called The Magicians of the Gods. It is all about where we came from as a society, and it has some claims that history and archaeologists are really, really struggling to denounce, but I think his book is a pretty definitive explanation of this. Sir, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hi, Jim. Nice to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I am blown away by the book. Let's tell quickly, everyone, what is the central thesis of Magicians of the Gods?
That we are a species with amnesia, but an entire episode of the human story, an advanced civilization that was capable of exploring and mapping the world, existed during the Ice Age, when our ancestors are supposed to have been simple nomadic hunter-gatherers, incapable of any scientific feats or any large-scale construction projects, and that this advanced civilization was destroyed by a cataclysmic event, a sustained cataclysmic event that unfolded between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. Geologists call this event the Younger Dryas. We already know that it was accompanied by massive animal extinction, huge extinctions of the megafauna, the woolly mammoths, the rhinos, and so on and so forth. Also by a radical and inexplicable plunge in global temperatures. And for a long time, scientists have been trying to understand what caused this mysterious event between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And the science is now in. There's a very solid body of scientific evidence has been published in the peer-reviewed press since 2007 evidences the impact of several fragments of a comet with the North American ice cap 12,800 years ago, which set this disaster in motion. It was, the epicenter was North America, but in fact, it was a global cataclysm almost on the level of the extinction of the dinosaurs. And I contend it wiped out an advanced civilization that now is only remembered in myths and tradition.
And the advanced civilization that you're talking about, it includes so many myths. It's Atlantis. It is, according to the book, also related to the Sphinx, the pyramids in Giza in Egypt, but it also left other, and perhaps Stonehenge, it left other archaeological sites around the world, some of which were hidden on purpose. Tell us about, yes, and I don't know how to pronounce this, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. Tell us about that.
In southeastern Turkey. Well, As I just need to preface that with a little bit more information on this cataclysm. As I said, it was between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. There were two spikes. The first spike was 12,800 years ago, animal extinctions and a big rise in sea level. The second spike, 11,600 years ago, more animal extinctions and an even more dramatic rise in sea level, which geologists call Meltwater Pulse 1B. Interestingly, 11,600 years ago is the date that the German Archaeological Institute has now established for the foundation of an extraordinary megalithic site in Turkey, which, as you rightly say, is Göbekli Tepe. And this site is 11,600 years old. If you envisage something like Stonehenge in England, but 50 times larger, then that's what we're looking at Göbekli Tepe. The intriguing thing is that there's no background. It just comes out of nowhere. In the case of Stonehenge, we supposedly have a settled agricultural community generating surpluses, in which specialists would arise, stonemasons and so on, division of labor, to create a big megalithic site. But in the case of Göbekli Tepe, the people are only hunter-gatherers, that area, and then suddenly pops up this extraordinary megalithic site with huge T-shaped pillars weighing up to 50 tons. No background to it whatsoever. At the same moment, agriculture suddenly appears in southeast Turkey and spreads very rapidly. Now, I suggest, rather than some astonishingly inspired group of hunter-gatherers magically equipped with the skills to undertake a very large construction project and invent agriculture, that we're looking at the transfer of technology here, and that this is a project of the survivors of a lost civilization who settle amongst hunter-gatherers and attempt to transfer their skills to them. And we see the effects of this. The best work at Göbekli Tepe is the oldest, which itself is counterintuitive. The site runs for about 1,000 years, and then, equally mysteriously, it's deliberately and meticulously buried. Everything is covered up. Actually, 50 times as much is still under the ground as has already been excavated, but they've been over the site with ground-penetrating radar and seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these huge pillars beneath the ground. So it was deliberately buried, and then for more than 10,000 years it was untouched until the German Archaeological Institute discovered it in the second half of the 1990s and began excavation. It's a very mysterious site, and it can't be explained within the existing model of history. But unfortunately, the existing model of history hasn't yet caught up with the evidence of the cataclysm. And that cataclysm occurs right in the foundations of what is thought of as the historical story.
And this cataclysm, is it what a lot of people would call the flood?
Well, yes, indeed it is, because it involved a massive global sea level rise. Of course, among scientists, any references to the flood, to biblical superstitions, are regarded as alarming and unwise. And that's part of the reason why it's difficult for science to adapt to catastrophist ideas. Science defined itself by separating itself off from religion and from notions like the flood of Noah. So to find ourselves confronted with evidence of such a flood creates a bit of an uncomfortable situation, particularly since 11,600 years ago, the second spike of the cataclysm is also the date that Plato gives for the destruction and submergence of the lost civilization of Atlantis. He said that happened 9,000 years before the time of the Greek lawmaker Solon. Solon lived in 600 BC, so that's 9,600 BC or 11,600 BC, 11,600 years ago. So if Plato made it up, as he's accused of doing, astonishingly on the money with the latest science.
All right. I have to ask, this is one of the things that I keep thinking about. Does your research give us any indication of where these advanced civilizations came from in the first place? You know, I watch the Discovery Channel and BBC, and sometimes you'll hear that aliens came and taught us how to build pyramids and gave us agriculture and stuff. Or,
I don't buy into ancient astronaut model at all. I don't need ancient astronauts. I've spent more than a quarter of a century traveling around the world studying the most mysterious and amazing archaeological sites on Earth, and I haven't seen anything that could only be explained by a civilization with the level of technology needed to cross interstellar space. What I see is evidence for the fingerprints of a lost human civilization, which was much more advanced than history presently allows for the period of time involved for the Ice Age, a human civilization with human concerns, capable of making human error. Human beings just like us, anatomically modern humans, have lived on this planet for at least 200,000 years. And I think that just as we today coexist with hunter-gatherer peoples, such as the tribes of the Amazon or the Kalahari Desert, so it was in the Ice Age that an advanced civilization coexisted with hunter-gatherer peoples. And it was the hunter-gatherer peoples, preferentially, who survived the cataclysm, perhaps because hunter-gatherers do have extraordinary survival skills, whereas specialized civilized people often don't know how to hunt and fish and, you know, make huts and plant crops.
Right. My wife and I joke that if there were a cataclysm today, that we would be the first people to die because we, you know, our advanced cooking skills, Graham, include reservations at the Ritz-Carlton for dinner. That's, you know, so.
Exactly. And it's an interesting thought because we feel we have a very strong civilization today, and we do, but its strength is its specialism. And the fact that people are so specialized means that, that if the bonds of society are broken by a cataclysmic event, our civilization would in fact be very fragile, whereas the hunter-gatherers of the Kalahari or of the Amazon rainforest would hardly be touched.
Right. All right. So, and you mentioned that there may be another cataclysm, and I definitely want to get back to that. But assume that we were told, and let's assume that this advanced civilization 12,000 years ago knew that something was going to happen. Why would we bury the existence of ourselves? It seems like we would try to create time capsules so that people would know that we were here and know how advanced we were. I wouldn't want to have no record of our civilization today. Why did the ancient, very advanced cultures hide themselves?
They didn't really. Göbekli Tepe was deliberately buried. But another site that I and my colleagues in this field have long felt has been wrongly dated is the Great Sphinx of Giza, which is a classic in Egypt, which is a classic megalithic monument carved out of solid rock. The Great Sphinx, there's much evidence to suggest that it was originally entirely a lion monument, a monument representing a huge lion facing east, that it was reworked and restored by the ancient Egyptians in the historic period around 2500 BC, when they recut the head of the lion and carved it into the head of a human being. But the weathering patterns on the flanks of the Sphinx and of the trench that surrounds it have been studied by Professor Robert Schock, professor of geology at Boston University. And he points out that this monument at some point in its career was subjected to more than 1,000 years of extremely heavy rainfall. And we've not had such rain in Egypt on the Giza Plateau in the last 5,000 years. Indeed, you have to go back to this cataclysmic time around 12,000 years ago to get the prolonged rain out that could have scarred the Sphinx in the way that it is scarred. So the hard science of geology suggests that the Sphinx is much older. It's been staring us in the face, evidence for a lost civilization, but archaeology has co-opted it to the later ancient Egyptian civilization, hence our confusion. In fact, I think there are many megalithic sites around the world that have been misunderstood and misdated. There's no direct way to date stone. Archaeologists have to use carbon dating of organic material, and sometimes that organic material can have been introduced by a later culture.
All right. I've been to the Sphinx, and it certainly is confusing to me. I don't really know enough to challenge any of the views, but it seems to me that what you're saying could be very plausible. I mentioned a minute ago that there could be another cataclysm coming. Can you speak of that?
I do speak of that because a group of astronomers, including Victor Kluve, Bill Napier, who's professor of astronomy at the University of Cardiff in Britain, and a number of other scientists have been paying attention to the torrid meteor stream, which our planet passes twice a year. The torrid meteor stream is the remnant of a fragmented giant comet. And the evidence is that this is the same comet, fragments of which hit the Earth 12,800 years ago. Further fragments hit the Earth 11,600 years ago. The most recent impact was in 1908, on the 30th of June 1908, the Tunguska incident in, fortunately, which happened over an uninhabited area of Siberia. Just a little bit of rock fell out of the torrid meteor stream in 1908, but it flattened 80 million trees across an area larger than London. So if that had happened over an inhabited area, we'd all be much more concerned about the Taurid meteor stream today. And the calculations of the astronomers and the mathematicians who work with them indicate that there are still several large bits of the original giant comet in the Taurid meteor stream, and that each passage through the Taurid meteor stream exposes us to risk, rather like strapping on a blindfold and crossing a six-lane interstate twice a year and just hoping that we don't meet any traffic, or that if we do, it would be motorcycles rather than trucks. The calculations indicate that there's one piece in there that might be 20 miles wide, and this would have a devastating effect on human civilization if it were to hit us. It's not gloom and doom. We have the technology to deal with this. At least 10 different technologies exist that could be deployed to sweep our cosmic environment clean. But at the moment, we're not making that choice. We choose to spend the big bucks on other things, particularly military expenditure, and we've rather got our eye off the ball. It could be done, but right now the choice is not being made. Presently, the international community is spending roughly what it costs to run one McDonald's for a year on observing potentially dangerous objects in our cosmic environment. And that's not good enough. We need to change that.
Well, McDonald's is pretty important. Maybe that'll be the thing that we pass on to another advanced civilization.
Yes, they were a strange culture that worshipped arches.
Yes.
Worshipped golden arches. Yes, that's right. That's what we'll be remembered of in 10,000 years from now when we're the next lost civilization.
All right, a little more seriously, why have you and your books been so heavily criticized? It seems to me that you're not a nut job. You're an economist reporter, one of the most prestigious institutions out there, one of the most esteemed periodicals of all time. Your pedigree is flawless. Your research is incredibly well documented. It seems to me that the case that you are making would be something that science would go, my goodness, thank you for this fantastic work. What's the underlying cause of the criticism?
The nature of science itself. There's a great book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, which outlines this. Actually, all scientists read it, but then they forget it. And what it shows is that science doesn't proceed with gradual and friendly acceptance of new ideas. When new ideas are proposed that are contrary to the existing view, they are ruthlessly attacked, sometimes for more than a century before they are accepted. It initiates a kind of territorial reaction on the part of the scientists who are invested in a particular worldview, and an attack on that worldview is taken almost as an existential attack upon themselves. And this is very normal human behavior. We all get invested in ideas and we all defend those ideas. Look at what people do in the name of religion, for goodness sake. So I think it's quite normal. I'm proposing an extraordinary hypothesis. I've been patient. I've been working on this for a quarter of a century now. The first big book, you rightly said, was Fingerprints of the Gods in 1995. 20 years have passed now. 2015, I brought in a mass of new evidence and new scientific evidence, mainstream science, not woo-woo, which supports the case that I made. And I'm hoping that this time around that somebody will actually read the book seriously rather than, you know, just dismissing me as a member of the lunatic fringe because I happen to hold ideas that are different from theirs.
Right. Let me ask you something that has nothing to do with the book, but you're the type guy that would know this. Global warming, what is your perspective on that? You've studied cataclysmic destruction of the Earth.
Yeah.
Do you buy into global warming?
My perspective on global warming is that it is happening, but that we are not clear about the causes. One thing that I know is that there have been incredible spikes of warming and freezing during the past. The Younger Dryas episode that I talked about between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago is one of those. I think that there are large factors at work involving the solar system as a whole, and that the human contribution to this may well be part of it, but it's not by any means the whole story. Nevertheless, philosophically, the way we're behaving on the planet, the burning, radical burning of fossil fuels, the pollution, the complete disregard for this beautiful garden that the universe has gifted us with. That's a mistake. That's a philosophical error. We shouldn't be doing that. Whether or not it contributes to global warming, we should be living more moderately. That should be a choice that we make on the grounds that it's right to do so, rather than to profligately continue to exploit and burn up the resources of the planet.
That makes a lot of sense. I completely agree with you. All right. Ark of the Covenant. Is that real?
Yeah.
Is the Indiana Jones, and I don't mean to, you know, say that that's the real story, but certainly that's what we associate it with in modern culture.
Yeah.
Does that Ark exist?
Well, that was a book that I published in 1992 called The Sign and the Seal. It was the first book I wrote about a historical history. And again, what I do is listen to what people say, listen to the mythology, listen to the traditions, and look at what there is on the ground. Ethiopia is the only country in the world that actually claims to possess the Ark of the Covenant and that has it as the centerpiece in its religious system. So I thought this is something really worth taking a look at. Scholars dismissed it. They thought it was a bad idea that the Ethiopians had just made it up. But when you look at issues like the Falashas, the black Jews of Ethiopia who practice an Old Testament form of Judaism, when you look at the fact that every single Christian church in Ethiopia, more than 20,000 of them, has a replica of the Ark of the Covenant in its Holy of Holies, obviously there's a story here. And I think the Ethiopians make a very good case, and I presented that case in my 1992 book. It set me on the path that eventually led me to Magicians of the Gods today. I moved out of current affairs because of that book in 1992 and became interested in investigating the mysteries of the past. And that's really what the new book, Magicians of the Gods, is all about.
All right. And so I have to ask this. Has this process made you into a religious person? Were you a religious person in the first place? Is this too personal a question, sir?
No, it's not too personal a question. I don't adhere to any of the mainstream religions. I regard Christianity, Judaism, and Islam as huge bureaucracies that are in the business of dividing us all from one another and have very little, in many cases, to do with spirituality. But I do regard myself as a spiritual person. I don't believe that death is the end. I can't prove that. But my strong instinct is that we are souls, we are spirits manifesting in human bodies, having a human experience here to learn and to grow and develop in this university of duality, and then moving on to the next level of existence. That's my belief. I can't prove it. I have reasons for it, but I wouldn't call it a religion.
All right. Well, then, is there a god that gave us the Ark in Ethiopia?
I have no idea. The Ark of the Covenant, as it's described in the Bible, sounds like a piece of technology. It's a weapon of destruction. Just touch it and you get slapped down with a bolt of fire. It was used constantly in warfare. I make the case that the Ark of the Covenant is a piece of lost technology from a lost civilization to which religious and spiritual ideas were subsequently attached.
All right. Fantastic. Sir, it's been an honor to speak with you. I love reading your work. It's been on my shelf for 10 years, and I have absolutely enjoyed my time with The Magicians of the Gods, which just came out and is selling incredibly well on Amazon and is incredibly well reviewed. Thank you for spending some time with us today, and congratulations on your incredible success.
My pleasure. And my website is grahamhancock.com. There's loads of information on the book there.
Perfect. Thank you for mentioning that. I appreciate that. Any social media you would like us to follow you on, or is it just the website?
On my website, there are links to my author Facebook page, and I'm very active on my author Facebook page, so that's a good place for people to get in touch with me.
Fantastic. Graham Hancock, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and I wish you a happy holiday season.
Thank you very much. Same to you. Thanks for having me on the show.
It has been our honor. We are out of time for today. Have a great day, everyone. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.